Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, March 28, 2014. This song for Roger Shuler. Less than 48 hours after he was released from 5 months plus of incarceration in Shelby County, Alabama, Roger Shuler spoke to us today here at the Peter B. Collins Show. And we covered a lot of ground in over an hour of conversation. The unedited podcast is available today for subscribers and others. In fact, I'm going to make sure that everyone can listen to it from day one. No subscription will be required to hear this powerful interview with Roger Shuler. And we talk about the events of October 23rd, when he was roughed up and arrested, taken into custody by sheriff's deputies who did not present a warrant. And we go into some detail about that. We also talk about the momentous events of November 14th, when Shuler, shackled and in jail garb, sat in a courtroom where he could barely hear what the judge was saying. And he describes the bizarre scene that when the judge first entered the courtroom, he took a man who appears to be his brother over and introduced him to Rob Riley, the plaintiff in the case against Shuler. And if that's not an indication of favoritism and the one-sided nature of justice in Alabama, I'm not sure what is. Here's an excerpt from that powerful conversation with journalist and blogger Roger Shuler.
And I do want to emphasize to your listeners, I mean, my physical and mental well-being was very much at stake for these past 5 months. I mean, I wasn't put in a place, you know, with accountants that maybe got caught putting numbers in the wrong row or something.
Yeah, there were no tennis courts, no golf available.
No golf, no tennis courts, you know, lots and lots of drug and alcohol issues. And I met a lot of inmates that I like and really don't, other than one person, I don't know who it was for sure, but somebody did steal from me my PIN account. But, but other than that, I really didn't have any unpleasant encounters, and most of them were very nice. And,
But you did witness a suicide inside the jail.
I did. A man of about 45 or so had come in, and we later were told by him that he had bipolar and schizophrenia, and I guess did not have his. You know, one of the things when you get incarcerated, Peter, or at least here in this jail, I mean, if you're on medication, I mean, you can get some medication, but some things like, say, for example, Xanax, which is considered, I guess, a controlled substance or whatever it's called, you can't get that. I don't know if treatment for schizophrenia or bipolar is available. And, you know, for whatever reason, he climbed up there were four cells, two stacked on top of two. As you walk in, it kind of looks like the Hollywood Squares. If you remember the old Peter Marshall game show?
Sure.
You know, where they had a tic-tac-toe, except we didn't have a third level to the top and a third row to the side, but it looked like kind of like a tic-tac-toe, and there were 14 bunks in each of the four. But unfortunately, there was a place where you could, if you wanted to, could climb up on the very top of the top bunk or top group of the top cells, and he, I'm told, just got on the edge, climbed up there, got on the edge, turned around, and just jumped off backwards and landed, and he landed about 12 feet from where I was sitting, and the sound of his head hitting the concrete, I'll never forget.
Wow.
I saw fights and near fights, one of the reasons I told Carol, kids, Carol, I don't want to die in here. And I'm sorry for getting emotional, but the last month or so, I was there for whatever reason. We just had a group of people that came in, and there were fights over the phones, and fights, and some were physical, and some, the majority were just anger, but it looked like fights. I mean, it's unbelievably stressful. And you can just be sitting eating your lunch, or is a fight going to break out? Not at me, but just, you know, somebody throwing a punch and it, you know, lands my way.
I invite you to listen to the full interview with Roger Shuler. It's available for all at peterbcollins.com today and on our affiliate sites like Stitcher, TuneIn, iTunes. Those are the places where you can find our podcasts on a regular basis. And today, I want to thank Anthony Morrow. He just signed up for a new annual subscription to the Peter B. Collins podcast, and frankly, the first new sign-up I've seen in a few days. And so I would like to implore you to join the people who support my podcast. Go to peterbcollins.com, follow the link under my picture that says sign up. You know the rest of the story. And in the interest of time, I'm going to curtail my typical message about your options and the $50 annual subscription and our bonus gifts of the CD and the Kona coffee. Because if you're able to support me, I also implore you to see what you can do for Roger and Carol Shuler. This last 5 months has really hurt them. And financially is really just one aspect, but that's one that you and I can help with. Their house is facing foreclosure at the end of April. And so they need help, and they need it soon. And if you know somebody who has deep pockets and a big heart, I invite you to steer them to legalschnauzer.blogspot.com. There's a PayPal button there, and I hope you'll be as generous as you possibly can. Our friend and colleague, Jason Leopold, the guy who has gone deep on so many important stories, has scored another coup. As you know, he has for a long time been focused on Abu Zubaydah, who was one of the first people grabbed after 9/11. He was tortured, waterboarded, and much more. He was held at a black site. He ultimately wound up where he is today, at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And Jason is such a great reporter, and he never stops digging. He brought us the story of Abu Zubaydah's brother, who lives in the United States, is hardly a jihadist, very different, the two brothers are. And in an exclusive report that I'll link to in the show file for this podcast, at Al Jazeera America today, Jason Leopold gives us another chapter on the young man known as Abu Zubaydah. He grew up in Saudi Arabia. And by contacting a former classmate or friend who grew up with Abu Zubaydah, Jason Leopold has, for one thing, acquired one of the few photographs of Abu Zubaydah. There are two previously in circulation. One is a kind of a mugshot. The other was photoshopped to add, I think, a beard or other facial hair by the U.S. government. And Jason managed to acquire a photograph of Abu Zubaydah. It looks like he's about high school graduation age, wearing, I think it's called a keffiyeh. Maybe they have a different word for it in Saudi Arabia, but the kind of headgear that's common in Arab nations. And the backstory on Abu Zubaydah and his friend Muhammad Sawalha is fascinating. And what makes this even more important is that from leaks that Leopold has been able to confirm related to the Senate Intelligence Committee's 6,000-page report on torture, detention, rendition, Abu Zubaydah features prominently there, because his torture occurred before John Yoo and Jay Bybee had written the memos to rationalize, legalize torture under the Bush government. And it is, I'll put it this way. Leopold has reported from his sources that the torture of Abu Zubaydah went even beyond the relaxed standards that were articulated by the Justice Department and by those two gentlemen, Jay Bybee, now with a lifetime appointment to a federal court, and John Yoo, a tenured professor at the UC Berkeley School of Law. So if and when we get to see at least a portion of the report from the Senate Intelligence Committee, the one that's being fought over between the CIA, Senator Feinstein, and the White House right now, we'll learn even more about what we did to Abu Zubaydah. We've been focusing the last few days on this political scandal in California involving State Senator Leland Yee of San Francisco. And as I pointed out, I've known Leland since he first ran for the state legislature. I actually shot one of the commercials for his first political campaign. And like many, I never thought that Leland Yee was an altar boy. But I had no idea he was involved with gangs and gun running and drugs and prostitution. And of course, it's diametrically opposite his political exterior. So today, his colleagues in the state Senate took a partial step toward dealing with the scandal in its ranks. Because Leland Yee is the third state senator and the third Democratic state senator to become part of a scandal this year. We have Rod Wright from Los Angeles, convicted of 8 felony counts related to voter fraud. He didn't live in his district. And the state Senate voted to suspend Rod Wright, Leland Yee, and the third senator who is under investigation and facing 28 counts of fraud and related issues, named Ron Calderon. Now, it appears that the law limits the ability of the Senate to merely expel a member in this situation. And its leader, Daryl Steinberg, frankly, has been very uneven. He at first protected Rod Wright and said, well, wait until the verdict is finalized and he's sentenced. Wright has been suspended or on leave, but has continued to draw a paycheck. Same with Calderon, and you can say, well, he hasn't been even tried, much less convicted yet, and we have to give him the benefit of that doubt. And you could apply that logic to Leland Yee. Well, I believe that whether it's part of the law or not, that the Senate should pass a resolution expelling these members. Pure and simple. They should be held to a higher standard than the conviction for a crime before they are forced to vacate their seats. And even if it led to litigation, where these tainted members could sue the state Senate for prematurely ejecting them, I think that's the message you need to send. And I think it's really tragic because we have one-party rule in California by the Democrats, and in other states we see one-party rule by Republicans going hog wild on public policy, tax cuts for the rich, banning unions, banning abortion, essentially. And the restraint of this supermajority has been, well, even greater than I had hoped for. But to apply that same restraint to disciplining members of your ranks who've been convicted or accused of serious crimes is just pathetic. That's about all I can say. Here in my backyard in Marin County, California, we're pretty proud of a charity group that was started by Heidi Kuhn. It's called Roots of Peace. And as I recall initially, they used to go looking for landmines in countries where a war was over, trying to prevent civilian deaths after the conflict. Well, now, they're involved in Afghanistan. They have 2 projects supported by the U.S. Agency for International Development, supporting Afghanistan's agriculture industry. And today, a suicide bomber and then a wave of reputed Taliban militants attacked their facility in Kabul. First, a suicide bomber imploded, and then 5 gunmen. entered the building, and there is a Christian daycare center in an adjacent or nearby building. It's not clear if that was a target. In any event, the Afghan police were able to track down and kill the five so-called militants, but an Afghan girl died in the crossfire. President Obama, after spending time in the glow of rock star Pope Francis at the Vatican, has moved on to another kingdom of God, this time Saudi Arabia. And he's there meeting with King Abdullah, Prince Bandar Bush, and the rest of the royal autocratic family. Will he talk about the status of women in Saudi Arabia or other issues? I doubt it. On the agenda is the alarm the Saudis feel because Obama hasn't been following their line as much as they would like, particularly on Syria. And secondarily, on Egypt. Saudi Arabia is very happy with the military dictatorship installed in Cairo now. And I think it's one of the reasons the U.S. has been silent in the face of this mass conviction and death sentence of individuals for an alleged riot in Egypt last year, and the total crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood. It offends American standards as they used to exist. And, of course, when it comes to Syria, Saudi Arabia is reported to be one of the major funders of the militant groups, the so-called rebels in Syria. Now, more than 3 years since the civil war started there. And, of course, last August we had this chemical weapons incident that they tried to blame on the Syrian government. But from the international reporters I've talked to, it seems most likely that Prince Bandar supplied those chemical weapons to militant groups, to the rebels in Syria, and tried to blame it on government forces. So I don't expect much to come out of the Obama meetings in Saudi Arabia. Probably a photograph of him holding hands and walking with King Abdullah. Surprise, 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 Mike Rogers, the former FBI agent, who's a member of Congress and chairs the House Intelligence Committee, the guy who has tried to use McCarthy tactics to say that Ed Snowden is a Russian spy. Well, the good news is he has decided not to seek re-election to Congress this year. The bad news from my point of view is he's doing this to launch a national radio show with a company called Cumulus that I used to work for here in San Francisco. And most recently, Cumulus had Mike Huckabee doing a show. They gave him a year and nothing happened, so he quit. They got Geraldo Rivera doing some syndicated talk. They recently picked up one of the most hateful voices in American media, Michael Savage. And they're going to add Mike Rogers to that lineup. Oh, boy. That's a real... it's a good thing to have him vacate the Congress and get out of the Intelligence Committee. But putting him on radio is a setback for the rest of us. And it's interesting. Rogers, you know, usually we've seen that members who are going to retire or decline to run for re-election, make that announcement in January or February at the latest. And Rogers waited until just 3 weeks before the filing deadline for someone to run to replace him in the Michigan primary. And this could be an intentional move because the word is that his brother, who is a member of the state legislature in Michigan and who is termed out, Bill Rogers, may try to jump in and run for the seat. He lives in the district. He's got the name Rogers, and his brother is sitting on almost $2 million in campaign cash that he could probably wangle away to spend on his brother. So we'll see how that one plays out. Now, here's an example of how Christians can be incredibly hateful and intolerant in the name of Christ. Earlier this week, a Christian charity group known as World Vision US that works to alleviate hunger announced in a very carefully worded press release that it was going to permit the hiring of married same-sex couples to work on behalf of those who are hungry. And within 48 hours, the blistering response from the Bible Thumper community showed that there is zero tolerance for Christians who tolerate gays, particularly those who are in a married relationship. So World Vision has reversed course, calling their decision a mistake and pleading with the Old Guard evangelicals for forgiveness. Its leader, Richard Stearns, said at first that it was a very narrow policy change and not an endorsement of same-sex marriage. But after being brushed back by the Thumpers, Stearns said, "Well, I made a mistake in judgment. The board and I were trying to create some space, some room for grace. What happened is we ended up creating a great deal more division than unity." Well, wait a minute. What does division and unity have to do? If you are united in hate, in intolerance, in ignoring the very message of Jesus Christ, the man you claim to be your role model and God, that's not an issue of unity. Not at all. You may know that I attended Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. And while I was there, because I'm not much of a sports fan, I only attended one football game in Dyke Stadium. Maybe it's got a different name now. But I was very pleased and a little bit tickled to learn that members of the football team at Northwestern have petitioned the National Labor Relations Board to recognize their desire to organize a union and to get paid to play college football. And I honestly, you know, haven't thought a lot about this, and I'm not an expert on all the issues related to college sports. But I look at the big picture. College football generates billions of dollars in revenue. It is a big business. The coaches all have, multi-million dollar salaries. But the team plays for free. It detracts from their studies. They pick up injuries. Some of them will never go on to the pros, so they're not really gearing up for a, big, highly compensated career in pro football themselves. And the amount of money that flows through these college sports operations is virtually obscene. And so I don't know how this will play out, because if the football team, the boys' football team, can unionize, then under Title IX, what happens to female athletes who are in similar situations playing in intercollegiate team sports? I realize there's a big can of worms here, but I've never been afraid of worms myself. Now, here is an expression of hypocrisy that floored me when I saw this story in the New York Times today. Sheldon Adelson, a man who is worth $38 billion and he made his fortune from casino gambling. He's the guy who allegedly has made bribes and payoffs in Macau, the former Portuguese colony that is near Hong Kong, now part of China. Big casinos in Macau. And, of course, he pumped about $100 million into Republican campaigns in 2012 on a serial basis, trying to find a horse that he could ride all the way to the White House, partly to try to address his concerns about a possible indictment over the bribes alleged at the Macau casino. So now, this guy who's made billions on gambling has formed a new group called the Coalition to Stop Internet Gambling. He's stacked it with conservative lawmakers and a few Democrats, too. He's pumped millions of dollars into their operation. And, of course, Sheldon Adelson hopes that they're going to build a coalition with people who are flatly opposed to gambling of all kinds, and that he can maneuver them into supporting his ban on internet gambling because it would compete with his casinos in the U.S. and elsewhere. And this is as breathtaking as the way that Jack Abramoff pumped $20 million of Indian tribal money into the state of Alabama at the same time that Don Siegelman was on trial, because Siegelman had tried to set up a state lottery that would have competed in some ways with the Choctaw Indians casinos in Mississippi. And despite the amount of money involved and the exposure that occurred when Jack Abramoff was on his book and rehabilitation tour a couple of years ago, I asked him about it, and boy, did he have a case of instant amnesia. He couldn't remember. Nah, somebody else handled that. So Sheldon Adelson, the casino billionaire, comes out against internet gambling. Isn't that special? This was kind of expected, but yesterday the appeals court in New Orleans upheld the Texas law that has forced a number of abortion clinics in Texas to shut down. What's hard to swallow is that the decision stated that the Texas law does not pose, quote, an undue burden on women's rights. And recently, Rachel Maddow's done some excellent reporting from the very southern part of Texas near the Mexican border. And women in that area don't have access to an abortion clinic anymore. And there used to be 30 across the entire state of Texas. It's now down below 20. And the law was a thinly disguised effort to limit access to abortion. You've probably heard about it. It requires that a doctor who runs an abortion clinic has to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital, but the nearby hospitals are generally forbidden from allowing those kinds of admitting privileges. And Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, has been very blunt that his goal is to make abortion unavailable in Texas without having to overturn Roe versus Wade. And who knows what will happen when this gets to the Supreme Court, which it inevitably will. And I'm very concerned that these issues of abortion, contraception, women's health rights are under a coordinated assault, and ground is being lost every day. And the Democrats, others on the left, don't appear to be doing a damn thing about it. And it, you know, why is a guy like me spouting off on it? We should be hearing women leaders all across the country sounding the alarm about this. But for reasons of their own calculation, we do not. And finally today, I'm sorry at the moment I'm unable to find a link for this op-ed from the San Francisco Chronicle, but it's signed by Ron Paul, the former 12-term congressman from Texas who ran for president a few times. And boy, did it sing to me over my crunchy raisin bran this morning. Let me read a few quotes for you from Ron Paul. The reaction of Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein to recent revelations that the CIA secretly searched Senate Intelligence Committee computers reveals much about what Washington thinks about the rest of us. Quote, spy on thee, but not on me, end quote. Feinstein's hypocrisy on this issue is astounding, says Ron Paul. She's an enthusiastic backer of the National Security Agency, spying on the rest of us, but when the tables are turned and her staff is the target, she becomes irate. But there's more to it. There's an attitude in Washington that the laws Congress passes do not apply to its members. They can trample our civil liberties, they believe, but it should never affect their own freedom. Much of this started after 9/11 with the Patriot Act. Those of us who warned that such extensive new government power would be used against us someday were criticized as alarmist and worse. The violations happened just as we warned. But when political leaders discovered the breach of our civil liberties, they did nothing about it. It wasn't until Ed Snowden and other whistleblowers informed us of the abuses that the so-called debate over surveillance happened at all. And he goes on to say, Washington does not care about our privacy. Both political parties are guilty. When serious violations are discovered, they most often rush to protect the status quo instead of defending the Constitution. Feinstein did just that as the NSA spying revelations began to create pressure on the intelligence community. Her NSA reform legislation was but a smokescreen. Under the guise of reform, it would have codified the violations already taking place. Well, Ron Paul, there's much that you and I will never agree on. But I salute you for your willingness to be the loner in Congress. The guy who was stubborn about observing the Constitution and not violating our Fourth Amendment and other elements of the Bill of Rights. And for that, I commend you, Ron Paul. Thanks for listening today. This podcast is free, and you are invited to distribute it to absolutely everyone. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.